Psalm 95 says, O come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. Let us come into his presence with thanksgiving. Let us make a joyful noise to him with songs of praise. For the Lord is a great God and a great King above all gods. In his hand are the depths of the earth. The heights of the mountains are his also. The sea is his, for he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. O come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker. For he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture, and the sheep of his hand. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as on the day at Massah in the wilderness, when your fathers put me to the test and put me to the proof, though they had seen my work. For 40 years I loathed that generation and said, they are a people who go astray in their heart, and they have not known my ways. Therefore I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Let's pray. Today, God, you have given us as a day of rest. You've made it for us. And we thank you for it. Pray your blessings upon it, that your name will be glorified as we now sing a new song to you. Amen. Okay, this morning we're going to carry on in Genesis chapter 42. As you will recall, Joseph's brothers have come to Egypt. They have met him there. He has accused them of being spies, imprisoned them, and now given them the ultimatum that they can go home, but Simeon must stay, and they are not to come back unless they bring Benjamin with them. That's where we are. So, I want to begin reading verse 25. We'll start there. And Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain and to replace every man's money in his sack and to give them provisions for the journey. This was done for them. Then they loaded their donkeys with their grain and departed. As one of them opened his sack to give his donkey fodder at the lodging place, he saw his money in the mouth of his sack. He said to his brothers, my money has been put back. Here it is in the mouth of my sack. To this their hearts failed them, and they turned trembling to one another, saying, what is this that God has done to us? So it turns out, it seems like whenever I study, I always run across these interesting little differences in words. And how they're used, and there's word choices of the author. And it turns out, like right from the beginning, we have one of those. So I'm going to just get that out of the way right off the bat and give you some food for thought. It's interesting that I read to you from the ESV, but in another version I was reading, in verse 25, it says, and Joseph gave orders to fill their vessels with grain. And so I was interested in that word, and I looked it up. And then I wondered about this word sack afterwards, because the word there that is rendered vessels in that other translation, which I think was in ESV, could be wrong. But yet here in ESV is bags. If you follow the story out, just looking at these words, because they kind of recur throughout the story. We're going to hear about these grain containers and their silver and these sacks and all this stuff. It's going to hear about it. In fact, we hear about it all the way through chapter 45 occasionally. So this is a little bit of a sneak peek. But it's interesting because the word there that I'll go with the ESV where it says bags. That's a different word than the next word in the same verse, sack. And like I said, that first word is, it means like a container, basically. It's not any particular kind of container, best I can tell. More of a generic term. And it specifically says that this is what they put the grain in verse 25, filled with grain. And then later that same verse, it says, replace every man's money in his sack. Now, as we go through this, the reason I want to go through this is because it's interesting that the different use of different words here, because they literally could have used the word sack for every time if they would have flowed in our normal reading of this, in our normal children's storybook, Bible storybook, where you're going to see that in the pictures, they open up these bags and there's these silver sitting on top of a corn or something. That's kind of the way I remember the storybooks to be. And it's not that that can't be the way it is, but it doesn't make a lot of sense to me why we're using different words if they're all rendering to the same thing. And initially, that's what I thought it did. I looked at it, I was like, oh, well, it's just probably, it's probably the same thing. But it's interesting, if you look through it, we're going to speed through all the different verses in the area I'm going to cover today, and even a little bit into 25, that talk about and use these same Hebrew words. So if you follow me, I'll go pretty fast here. In 25, I'm going to give you Strong's numbers only because it's going to help you differentiate between the words. This first word, vessels, is 3627. And so we have 3627 and 8242 in verse 25. That's what I said could be vessels. It's bags in ESV. And this 8242 is sack. And this is sack in here in 25 in the ESV. And it literally is the word for like sack cloth or a coarse cloth. So that's pretty common. It's the kind of material used, kind of like we would maybe say burlap kind of material to give you like a flavor of what I think this material was likely was like. So then in 27, we're going to find that it says one of them opened his sack. Now, this is the 8242 word, the second word of 25, not the vessel word, but the sackcloth word, the sack. So this one in 27, he opens his sack and found silver in his mouth. And that word is fine to be mouth. It means an opening. It's broader than just an opening. It has a lot of different ways. Basically it means inside something. Sort of, it could be in the open. It could be in the middle. It could be in the edge. It's not a specific. But mouth is fine if we want to use the word mouth, because a lot of the vessel or sack has a mouth to it, like an opening, right? So you could say opening instead of mouth if you wanted to. So he also, as I threw this, listen for the singular versus plural as I do this. So in 28, it says, it's going to say, I haven't read this in my, I didn't read this in the open. He said to his brothers, my money has been put back here. Yeah, it did. In 28, wait a minute, see here. 27 describes what happens. He opens his sack, his 8242 sackcloth, and sees his money in the mouth of his sack, 8242. Same word there. And then 28, he's talking to his brothers, says, my money's been put back here in the mouth of my sack in ESV, but it's a new different word. It's actually a third word. It's actually Strong's 572. And this is literally bag. I mean, like, in the sense that there's not a whole other options it is when you look at the Hebrew. It's bag. So this is interesting. Then we got this third word that is being basically called a sack, literally a bag. And if you skip all the way down to verse 35, they're back home, and it says, I'll just go to it, make sure I get exactly right. Okay, now they emptied their sacks. Behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And now this is back to the same sackcloth, 82:42 word. And it's the same word in both cases. Interesting also, I like the ESV here because every man's bundle of money, and bundle is good. Other ones have sack there. So it confuses it even more because we're using this word sack for everything. We're using it now possibly for four different Hebrew words. So we keep going in chapter 43, verse 12. Jacob's talking. He says, take double the money with you. Carry back with you the money that was returned in the mouth of your sacks. Now we're back to 572, where that third instance, which literally means bag. So he could have just said in the interest of your bag. And then we keep going in 44:1. Joseph is commanding the steward of the house. He says, okay, this is after they've had the big reveal and they're kumbayaing a bit together. They're all, you know, which is a good thing. Like, I mean that in a good positive sense. They're making up and having a good time. They had a big old dinner. And now Joseph is fixing to send them home. And he says, he commands the steward of his house, fill the men's sacks, 572, literally bags, with food, as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack, 57:2 again. And then later in the same, he says, that's where he says to put the cup in Benjamin's, 572, which is bag, or they're going to render it sack again. And then in verse 8, again, word 572, behold the money we found in the mouths of our sacks or bags. Bags is the 572. And then in verse 11, each man now is going to lower his bag, 572. So each man has his bag. And that's where they're going to look for the cup and the silver. And they're not going to find the cup until they get to Benjamin's. And that's in verse 12. 572, again, it's a 572 word, found in the bag or the sack of Benjamin. And then lastly, this, I think, helps me. Hopefully it will help you as well. In chapter 45, verse 23, read this right quick. So Joseph gave, in 21, he gives him wagons. And in 22, a change of clothes. And then in 23, it says, to his father he sent as follows, 10 donkeys loaded with good things of Egypt, and 10 female donkeys with grain, bread, and provision for the journey. Okay, so I throw that one in there to show you that they're getting more than just the grain. You know, we talk about Joseph's story of the grain. So there's this, you know, they went to Egypt to buy grain, right? But as I look at the whole context here, and I got three different words, this is the story I see. I don't think it conflicts, but if you want to go with the children's storybook version, it's not that as bad. It may be correct, but it looks to me like since when they originally come the first time, it says that they have vessels to fill with grain, and they use a different word later, where Joseph's going to give them a bunch of bags of grain, like using the word it means bags. This is what I see happen. I see that it's the beginning of the famine. They have no idea. Remember, you got to remember, this is like they have no idea how long this famine is going to last. Joseph does. Pharaoh does. But maybe a bunch of people in Egypt do because Joseph told them. But Jacob and his family have no idea. They just know, well, our stores are running low. Everywhere we look around, there is a famine. We didn't get any rain or whatever. It doesn't say exactly why there's a famine, but we assume maybe didn't get rain. So y'all go, and I heard there's grain in Egypt. Y'all go down to Egypt and get us some grain. And I'm thinking that they're likely not thinking this famine is going to last a long time. I mean, they've probably had bad years before. Maybe it's just they think it's a bad year. I don't know what they're thinking. I'm just saying that when they go down, they're taking vessels. And a lot of times they would have these pots, and they could hang them on the sides of donkeys to fill up. And that would fit the idea of a vessel better than a bag. But a bag could be a vessel too. But anyway, so I'm just trying to wonder why we're using different words. I'm just trying to look a logical reason why it might be a different word. So maybe they took these pots, these vessels to start with, and they're down there. And then here's the thing. Back to 25 in chapter 42, fill their bags or vessels. This is the only time the word vessels is used. That one word. It's used this one time. And the rest of the time we either have the sack, like sackcloth, or we have the bag word. You follow me? Okay. So Joseph gave orders to fill their vessels with grain and replace every man's money in his sack. Different word. Okay? And then they're going to get the next time you hear about this. What they've done is they have actually stopped in their journey, and it says in 27, at the lodging place. Now, again, my picture in my head was that these are nomads. They're nomadic people. I thought to myself to begin with, well, even if it says lodging place, it probably means that that's just the place they stop and pitch their tents to take a break in their travels. But no, I looked into it, and it's actually like it means an inn. So like literally they're going to stop at a structure. Well, that brought up a whole new idea of, you know, what this is going on. It's like, oh, well, that's probably, you know, if you stop at an inn, I think about Mary and Joseph and, you know, at the inn. There was no lodging at the inn, right? Or whatever word you want to use. I'm sure they didn't use the inn word, but I-N-N. But, there was what was behind it. There was a stable behind it, right? In the Mary and Joseph story, there's a stable associated with the inn. So, like, there could have been a stable there with that, too. So that changes the paradigm for me. That changes the paradigm for me personally. So I'm just sharing this with you. So now, when he goes to get his, 27, opens his sack to give his donkey fodder. I always thought that meant we're going to open this sack, we're going to scoop out some corn and go feed it to the donkey. It could mean he went to his sack to feed his donkey, which he needed some money to go pay the innkeeper to feed the donkey. So, because he's not just out there in the middle of nowhere. So that option to me becomes possible. Again, here, so so that's where he finds his bundle of silver, in his sack. Again, I think about this and I think, it's singular, it's one sack. And it appears that each brother has a sack. I'm sure that you would think they would bring more than one sack per person to go all the way to Egypt and get some food. I bet they would bring a bunch of sacks, right? And why would it be just his sack? Now, could it mean one of his sacks of the many he brought to put all his grain in? Yeah, I think possibly it could mean that, but it's single. It's his sack. And so what if his sack is just like a duffel bag? It's like his personal sack. And he keeps his money in there. He keeps whatever else he's doing in there. This is not what the grain went into. This is something else, possibly. So that's why, and I'm saying that because maybe that's why it's a different word, because they were two different things. So, and then they get back, also, another reason. Here's another thing. They get back, and they tell Jacob the story, and it's like, it appears to me like some time kind of goes by, like a little bit of time goes by. I mean, maybe they rolled in, and the first thing they did is go talk to him and tell him everything happened. Could have been, very could have been. I don't mean it was weeks. I mean, maybe a day or two. But it's then, like, it takes them a minute, and then every man goes to his sack and finds his silver in his sack. It also, it was a little bit odd to me when you start thinking about it, it's like that they would take the silver and chuck it in there with the grain. I mean, eventually they're going to find it, I guess, but if they brought a bunch of sacks, How long would it take before they found the sack with the silver in it? I mean, it might take them a while. So all this stuff's going through my head. So, and then lastly, their sacks get, in 44:1, Joseph commands his steward, fill the men's sack with food, as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack. I always just thought that the food there was the grain. But it didn't have to be. When you think about it later, where they come back loaded with grain, bread, and food. So the grain was a type of food. But it wasn't what they could, I mean, it wasn't going to be easy for them to eat it on their travels. So provisions is the word that comes to my head. It was their provision sack. Which, guess what? You're going to get in your provision sack a lot sooner than you're going to go get into this grain, assuming you don't need the grain to eat on the way home. So all those things go to my head to give you a possible different look on this situation, where maybe they weren't, it was silver wasn't just stuck on top of some corn in a sack, which is the way I always thought about it. So, and it, to me, it gives an explanation for why we're using three different words for these different things. Vessels and sacks and bags and that sort of thing. And then the last thing would be that when they go back the second time and they're going to come back home, it does say they put the grain in bags. Well, Joseph knows how much they're going to need. They're going to need, I mean, to get home, and he knows the famine's not going to be over. So maybe that's what, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. That is 100% speculation. You can throw that away as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, I'm trying to figure out why there were three different words for this, for these different, apparently different containers that didn't appear to be there. Why wouldn't they just say bag for all of them? That was my conclusion. You can take that or leave it. That was free. All right. Now, so we basically covered that section, except for at the end where the brothers see the silver and they are afraid. All right. We're back in 42, verse 25. No, we're not. We're 28. Their hearts failed them, and they turned trembling at one another, saying, what is this that God has done to us? So, I want to deal with this phrase, this exclamation of sorts that they say, what is this that God has done to us? First of all, this is an instance of Elohim, not Yahweh. It is singular, or the verb done, what has Elohim done to us is singular. So they're not saying, what have the gods done to us? They're saying, what has God done to us? Singular. So they do attribute this to God, the Most High God. They just don't use the name Yahweh here, but they say, what has God done to us? They are fearful. The question is, what are they fearful of? I think it doesn't tell us what they're fearful of. They're fearful that they have received their silver back, and now they're asking what, you know, they're sort of like saying, what has God done to us? Seems to me most likely they're fearful of what would happen with Joseph, and now that they it's like, oh, he just accused us of being spies, and now here we are, we got our money back like we stole it. But it doesn't say exactly what they're fearful of Joseph, or they're fearful of God. Like, literally, what has God done to us? We're afraid of God. Like, was the fear of God in them? I don't know. It doesn't say. It doesn't really tell me for sure. I do think that in some parts, they're expressing their natural understanding that the spiritual world has impact on the physical world. That there is a God. Probably they believe that there are more than one God. That there are gods in their culture. It was a, you know, polytheistic culture. But they do acknowledge one God here. So that's good. They're on the right track. So I do believe this is expressing that understanding of it. We do have, so the question is, like, are they blaming God? Like, what's God done to us now? Or are they like acknowledging God's sovereignty and like, what has God done to us? Because God is in control of all things. We do see in the pattern in the scriptures, there's many different, there's a, there are different times where we have a pattern of direct attribution to God of harm or affliction, especially like in the book of Lamentations. It's like the whole book is kind of that way. But like here's an example, Lamentations 3:1-3. Let me just look it up here. I have the choppy version on my paper here. I am the man who has seen affliction. Under the rod of his wrath, he has driven me and brought me into darkness without any light. Surely against me turns his hand again and again the whole day long. And the he there is God in there. Job also lamented in 19 verse 6. Can read that right quick. If I speak, my pain is not assuaged, and if I forbear, how much of it leaves me? That wasn't the one I was thinking. 16:6, my bad. Know then that God has put me in the wrong and closed his net about me. And then the Psalms are also full of these. 88:14, why Yahweh do you reject my soul? It's like implication, God is the one doing this to me. Why are you doing this to me, God? I guess my what I want to say here is it's not always clear. It's not always even clear to myself sometimes I may not say like, why God have you done this? But if I get frustrated about something, I'm like, why is this happening? You know, I can be angry. I can be angry with God for letting something happen. And so I think ultimately that comes down to your heart and what's in your heart at the moment. And it can be an attribute. You can say, okay, God, you are doing this and I don't like it. Why are you doing this? And that could be very much a appeal to sovereignty, appeal to like, just please help me, that sort of thing. So it really boils down to the heart. We're not exactly told here what their hearts were doing, but it is something that's common to man. So if we have those situations and times where we are frustrated or we're feeling overwhelmed and we cry out to God, if we cry out to God without a perfect heart, God can forgive that as well. So just be attentive to your heart. Okay. Now in verse 29, they're arriving home. We're going to read this next section. When they came to Jacob, their father, in the land of Canaan, they told him all that had happened to them, saying. And then basically, I'm going to skip from 30 to 34, 30 to 33, because they give the same account that we read earlier. There is no attempt to deceive. They give their father a perfect report, best we can tell. So that's just good. In verse 34, it says, they're talking about what Joseph said, and he said, bring your youngest brother to me, then I shall know that you're not spies, but honest men, and I will deliver your brother to you, and you shall trade in the land. So they had said in verse 31 that they had told the man, hey, we're honest men. So just right quick here, I looked into that a little bit because it's like, wait a minute, how you guys told your dad that your brother was dead? We didn't really tell him that. We just showed him the coat. He kind of assumed that on his own. Well, maybe so. But they've been living with that deception their whole lives. And so it's interesting that they would call themselves honest men. Now, maybe they turned a new leaf and they are honest men now, possibly. However, it is interesting that the word it's not really the same kind of way we think of honesty as our English word honesty. It's more of, I'm not hiding anything. I am as I seem, that's fine. It could be a form of honesty to be that way, but it also fits more with trying to avoid the challenge of being a spy. a spy is definitely not being as they seem. So for them to say, hey, we're as we seem. We're just these guys coming down to get grain. Hey, we're just honest. That's to me what they're saying here. So continuing on in verse 35. Let's see, this is supposed to be 40. As they emptied their sacks, behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when they and their father saw their bundles of money, they were afraid. See, this is what I'm talking about. It's like, it sounds like they emptied their sack, like singular, one sack. And it didn't talk about like any other sacks. So that's what part of that flavor comes from. And Jacob, their father, said to him, you have, and they were afraid. Interesting, in another translation it says, and they and Israel were afraid, and Jacob were afraid. Actually, usually were Jacob. So it's interesting that in another translation, and I didn't realize ESV was going to be that way. I had to go back and see if it actually has both their names. Maybe somebody could check that. If it says just they, or if it says the brothers and Jacob were afraid. And my other rendering was made them and Jacob afraid. All right, and carrying on, it says, and Jacob their father said to them, you have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more, and now you would take Benjamin. All this has come against me. Then Reuben said to his father, kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands, and I will bring him back to you. But he said, my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is the only one left. If harm should happen to him on the journey that you are to make, you would bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to Sheol. Okay, so here, interesting, Jacob is now afraid too. Remember, the brothers were afraid when they first saw it on the way at the lodging place. Now Jacob sees the silver. The brothers were afraid whenever they found the first bag of silver. Now they found all the rest of the bags, and them and Jacob are afraid at this point. Jacob now is going to have his own lamentation and basically say, you guys are killing me. Two sons are gone, and now you've stolen this money back from them. And what are you trying to do? It's kind of like after the Shechem thing. What are you trying to do? So Reuben tries to console his father, but his father refuses. Interesting, because Reuben was the oldest, and we learn when Joseph doesn't come back, he's sort of held responsible there as well. And so here he is again. He's led another expedition and come back without a brother. So Jacob refuses. It's almost like he lost faith in Reuben. He refuses, and he says that Benjamin will not go down with you all. Plural. Says, nope, Benjamin will not go with you all. Like implication, you all will go, but he's not going to go. And we dealt with the Sheol thing, the Sheol last time we talked about this. So, however, the question is, William, is this more favoritism on Jacob's part here? And I wanted to give my two cents on that. I think that probably that we are not picking this word apart enough. Favoritism definitely has a negative connotation to it. But we also have, and we do have places in Scripture talks about don't show favoritism. You went over those, I think. James 2, if you remember, it talks about showing favoritism. Basically, James 2 condemns making distinctions or showing favoritism. Making distinctions is another way to say that. Based on external status. And then we have other places where it says, so there's external status, and then another place talks about all believers are equal in front of God, inside of God. So there we have spiritual equalness there. So So definitely there are times where there can be an inappropriate showing of favoritism or distinctions, is another way to say it. However, other places, it is taught that we can show a type of favoritism. Now, we use the word favoritism, again, pretty loosey-goosey, but I think that favoritism, and we might just should relegate that to the negative side, and we'll use a different word for the positive. And we'll call that, like the Bible uses the word appreciation and honor. Honor being the one I would choose, honor. We're going to show honor to somebody. So like in Romans 13:7, render to all their due, render to everybody what they deserve, that equalness, that equal in front of God, not going to put the poor less than the rich because how much money they have. We have equal value in the sight of God. Each man has equal value in the sight of God. Render all their due. Tribute to whom the tribute is due. Custom to whom the custom is due. Fear to whom the fear is due. And honor to whom the honor is due. So honor is an elevation of sorts that you would give to somebody who is due that honor. And then 1 Timothy 5:7, where it talks about let the elders who rule well be considered worthy of double honor, more honor than another elder or another individual. So they're getting honor. They're getting extra appreciation, more appreciation, a higher level of appreciation or honor without denying basic respect to others. It's not said, but it's implied. So there's not a contradiction there. It's like give all their due, but it's okay that somebody gets more than another in some instances. And then in Ephesians 6, slaves, obey your masters with fear and trembling, which is kind of like a deference to their role. Masters treat slaves justly, giving them their due as a man, another man. And so this structure permits role-based preferences there as well. So there's no passage that condemns showing preference to someone. What it condemns is not giving everybody their what's due them, but their due. So if Jacob was neglecting his other sons and not neglecting Joseph and Benjamin, then that would be definitely favoritism. But if he was giving them their due and he was providing for them and being a father to them as well, the fact that he's going to give extra attention and honor to the sons of Rachel doesn't necessarily need to be a negative favoritism. Now, the fact that the brothers didn't handle that well doesn't necessarily mean this was a Jacob problem. It could have been a Jacob problem. It could have been a brother's problem. Could have been. So we don't know because we're not really told. We just know that they did hate Joseph because of this honor that was given to him by his father. And that's sort of that's all I had to say about that, I think. I think we have to be careful there on that. And I've lost my place here. But Jacob is still treating the sons of Rachel differently than the rest of his children here. He's saying, nope, you all going to go back, and Benjamin's not going. So, we carry on in chapter 43. It says, now the famine was severe in the land, and when they had eaten the grain that they had brought from Egypt, their father said to them, go again and buy us a little food. But Judah said to him, the man solemnly warned us, saying, you shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. If you will send our brother with us, we will go down and buy you food. But if you will not send him, we will not go down. For the man said to us, you shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. Israel said, why did you treat me so badly as to tell the man that you had another brother? He replied, the man questioned us carefully about ourselves and our kindred, saying, is your father still alive? Do you have another brother? What we told him was in answer to these questions. Could we in any way know that he would have said, bring your brother down? And Judah said to Israel, his father, send the boy with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and you, and also our little ones. I will be a pledge for his safety. From my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, let me bear the blame forever. If we had not delayed, we would now have returned twice. So, as Joseph knew, the famine continues, and he knew that they would run out of grain. I think Benjamin talked about that. And the grain has now been finished, and yet, according to verse 10, they have lingered. They have not wanted to go back. In fact, it turns out my best calculations from what I could understand from researching this was that with donkeys traveling from Canaan down to Egypt was probably about a two-week journey one way. A little bit quicker than I thought. But if you're going to go down there, and even if you saw the, if you were able to get your supply of grain the day you got there, you're still talking about a month's worth of travel there and back. Israel here, it says, it's interesting because it calls Jacob Israel here. I did look into the Jacob versus Israel, and there are many places you can go, and you can hear people talk about why he's called Israel here, he's called Jacob there. But if you, from what I could gather, most of that is just an interpretive thing. They're applying their own interpretation to why I would be here, why I would be there. It turns out, from what I can tell, there's no like inherent pattern. It's not like Jacob until this point, and it's Israel from there on. Even from here on out, it's going to be mostly Israel. It's going to be called mostly Israel, but it's going to occasionally be called Jacob in there as well. And then even later, when the nation of Israel, when it's separated from Judah, occasionally it's even called the sons of Jacob as well. Many times when they're not doing good things, but. I didn't want to get into that since I couldn't find a clear pattern. So Israel says, why did you do this evil to me? And now I'm seeing myself here sometimes because I can just feel this in Israel right now. Like, why did you do it that way? Why did you do that? And I get it. I mean, I can certainly feel Israel here, like major. But I can also, I mean, it's also not really fair for Israel because he wasn't there. He wasn't in the moment. And so for him to say that. But I can certainly understand why he's saying it. I think he's showing his humanity here and lamenting that they would even say in the first place. I do find it interesting. And I will say that when I catch myself doing this, I repent of it when I try to do better than I used to do. I used to fall off the handle, but now I try to catch myself. But it is interesting though that the brothers answered that it wasn't just that Joseph said, "You're a spy," and they're like, "No, we're not," and just blah 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 blah, you know, like. Just started blabbing all this information out. I mean, there could have been some of that. I'm sure it set them up to be very like, oh no, I want to explain why we're not spies. But it does say here that Joseph actually literally like specifically asked them specific questions too. So I think there was a little both going on. Joseph was using it to his advantage. But I thought it was interesting here that we get a little bit more information, a little bit more detail about that interaction that happened when they were first in front of Joseph there. Kind of remind me that when we were talking about that, it reminded me of the scenes of the good cop, bad cop in the interrogation room. You know, that kind of thing. So Judah says, hey, look, Reuben's already offered this same thing, by the way. But now Jacob finds himself really in a corner. They really need some food now. And Judah steps up and says, hey, you know, if I don't bring them back, I'll bear the guilt forever. Like he's going to personally bear the guilt. And I think that, I don't think it was Judah necessarily that changed Israel's mind. I think it was God. Because what I see happening next is Jacob finally submitting to God in this. And finally trusting God. Maybe it's just a mustard seed of faith, but he sees that this is a situation where God's put him back in a corner and he has no choice but to trust God now. And we're going to read that now. Then their father Israel said to them, "If it must be so, then do this. Take some of the choice fruits of the land in your bags, and carry a present down to the man, a little balm and a little honey, gum, myrrh, pistachio nuts, and almonds. Take double the money with you. Carry back with you the money that was returned in the mouth of your bags. Perhaps it was an oversight. Take also your brother and arise, go again to the man. May God Almighty grant you mercy before the man, and may he send back your other brother and Benjamin." They didn't know he was going to get Joseph too. "And as for me, if I am bereaved of my children, I am bereaved." So Israel said, "Take everything. Just take it all. Take it all to him. Hopefully he'll find favor in this guy's sight, and he will allow your brothers to come back with you." At this point, it's about survival. It's about putting the important things first. They had lingered already. Could have gone back twice. And now he says, take the good stuff. Take everything. It all won't matter unless you come back with grain and you come back with my sons. It won't matter. None of it will matter. Interesting that the things that they're going to take are things that you could store up and they last a long time. So, you know, it wasn't perishable stuff. I thought that was kind of interesting because they're in the middle of a famine. So they had some stores left, but they weren't completely out. But apparently they were getting low. So Jacob's finally here. Jacob, and he's called Israel, is completely submissive to God. God put him in the corner with no other options left but to walk in faith. This is where the faith that we're given is so precious. Because when others who don't have this faith get in these corners, they have nothing to hold on to except their pitiful selves. We have other examples in the Bible of this happening as well. Where there's initial resistance, there's fear, hesitation regarding a difficult course of action that eventually there's submission when there's clear there's no other choice. In some ways, Abraham is our best example and did it the best as far as we can tell, as far as we're told in Scripture. As far as we're told in Scripture, God commands Abraham to offer Isaac as a burnt offering, and Abraham obeys without any recorded verbal reluctance. We're told in Hebrews that he believed that even if he did kill him, God would raise him from the dead. And when Isaac asks, "Where is the sacrifice?" Abraham responds, "In faith that God will provide it." Other examples, we have Moses not wanting to go talk to Pharaoh until God puts him in a corner and sends him anyway. We have Jonah not going on to go to Nineveh, and God changes his mind about that. And I don't know about this one. I'll leave this to you guys, but Esther didn't want to go talk to the king, and she did go. So kudos to her. So these are times that test our faith. Times when our strength runs out. Our provisions run out. We have no one to lean on but God. In those times, we can be like Job, and we can say, though he slay me, yet I will hope in him.